Chapter 1, A Most Unlikely Development. Something interesting has been happening within evangelicalism over the last few years. A long neglected and almost forgotten topic has reemerged as a viable topic of discussion. What was considered a bit taboo, uncouth even, is being looked at again with fresh eyes in many quarters. One could even sense a bit of urgency in the discussion, a growing momentum of conviction and a boldness in calling people back to this long-lost topic. The topic is church discipline. Consider, in February 2005, Ron Sider, the well-known author of Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, published a little book entitled The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience. In it, he chronicles the shocking moral life of evangelical believers in the United States. A skyrocketing divorce rate, minuscule giving, racial prejudice, etc. Near the end of his book, he offers some proposals to address this scandal. The first one, the reinstitution of church discipline in congregational life. Consider, Christianity Today, largely regarded as the flagship publication of evangelicalism, publishes a cover story for its August 2005 issue with these words boldly affixed across the top of the magazine cover, Fixing Church Discipline. To be sure, the curious drawing beneath these words, a man on his knees bent over with his head and hands entrapped in wooden stocks in the shape of a church, his helpless face crowned with a large scarlet A on his forehead, conjuring all the caricatures of Hawthorne's oppressive Puritan New England, seemed to suggest in a none too subtle manner that legalism concerning church discipline, and not more accurately, outright neglect, is the great danger we face. Nonetheless, the five articles on church discipline in this issue are a credit to the magazine, and give one hope that the great tragedy of the disappearance of church discipline from congregational life in North America and beyond is finally being recognized and addressed. The growing sentiments of sympathy toward church discipline are no less obvious in my own denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention. The winter 2000 issue of the Southern Baptist Journal of Theology, the journal of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, was dedicated entirely to the issue of church discipline. It contains an editorial, five articles, one sermon, and a roundtable forum calling for Baptists to reconsider church discipline. In May 2005, Danny Aiken, president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, preached a sermon entitled Church Discipline in a Southeastern chapel service. On June 11, 2005, in two overflow sessions at the Southern Baptist Pastors Conference in Greensboro, North Carolina, Mark Dever, pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., and founder of Nine Marks Ministries, called upon Southern Baptist pastors to return to the lost practice of church discipline. A September 29th and 30th, 2006 conference at the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, was titled Maintaining the Integrity of a Local Church in a Seeker-Sensitive World, the Baptist Perspective on Baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Church Discipline. At this conference, a number of Southern Baptist Seminary professors and pastors gathered to consider, among other things, how church discipline might be reclaimed in a church climate gone awry. Furthermore, numerous Baptists have called for a renewed consideration of church discipline in a number of recent books. This is just a sampling of the many calls coming from within the convention for Southern Baptists to prayerfully consider a return to biblical church discipline. These examples and others are signs of hope, yet it cannot be denied that the practice of church discipline has yet to make anything like a substantial impact on evangelical congregational life in North America. It is still tragically ensconced in the conversations and conferences and lectures of evangelical academia. Many churches that do practice church discipline are stellar in their examples, but they are also the exception and not the rule. James Leo Garrett Jr.'s 2004 observation that there is little evidence of a renaissance of the intentional and consistent practice of any congregational discipline in churches related to the larger Baptist conventions in the United States remains irrefutably true. There have been many theses put forth to attempt to explain exactly why church discipline disappeared. Gregory A. Wills has chronicled the disappearance of church discipline from Southern Baptist congregations. In the 1870s, writes Wills, the practice of church discipline in Southern Baptist churches began to subside. The trend accelerated in subsequent decades. By the 1930s, discipline was quite rare. Most reported exclusions were merely the cleaning of church rolls of names of members long inactive and forgotten. In the 1940s, most associations stopped bothering to record exclusions. A fear of the abuses of church discipline is widely regarded as one of the reasons for its widespread abandonment, but there are many others as well. John MacArthur, Jr. lists 4 P's to explain why church discipline has disappeared: privacy, permissiveness, pride, persecution of sinners by gossiping Christians. J.W. McGorman cites the abuses of the past, a low level of Christian commitment in our churches, the decline of adequate pastoral care in large congregations, the ease with which excluded members may simply go to and join other congregations, sympathy for an offender's family, and a fear of litigation. J. Carl Laney cites some interesting statistical data that sheds some light on this phenomenon. In a recent survey of 439 pastors on the matter of church discipline, 50% acknowledged situations in their ministry where discipline would have been appropriate, but no action was taken. 3 major hindrances to the practice of church discipline were mentioned: fear of the consequences or outcome, preference for avoiding disruptive problems, and ignorance of the proper procedures. Stephen M. Haynes has detailed a number of reasons for the decline of church discipline, including the secularizing results of increased urbanization and industrialization in American society, an overreaction to previous abuses of church discipline, the encroachment of Enlightenment optimism and the rejection of Calvinist theology, an emphasis on individualism, and the importation of secular management techniques into the life of the church. In his fascinating study of the decline of church discipline in the Church of Scotland at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, Stuart J. Brown notes that an unbalanced preoccupation with sexual offenses, a distorted use of church discipline against women, and the unforgiving nature of the church's policy of discipline led to its demise. R. Stanton Norman points to the rise of a stringent individual autonomy, the absolute relativism that pervades Western secular society, a general lack of respect for authority within the church, differing denominational policies, confusion over Christian accountability within the local church, and the rising fear of litigation. Most damning of all, however, is Norman's observation that the fear of a loss of revenue has hindered Baptist churches from practicing discipline. This list is not exhaustive, and many other factors might be mentioned, but it will certainly not be closer to being complete until biblical illiteracy is added. Indeed, this lack of knowledge of what the contents of the Bible actually are is almost certainly the most prevalent reason for the disappearance of church discipline from the life of the church. Regardless of the reasons, it would be hard for even the most casual observer to deny the absence of that communal accountability in the life of the average church that church discipline brings. As shown above, there are many and varied reasons that students of the topic have mentioned to account for this neglect. However, it is perhaps not inappropriate to suggest that an unstudied and non-technical observance of the workings of the average church life provides its own proof for this reality. In other words, personal experience must be taken into account as well. It would be difficult, for instance, to find a member of a church who has not either experienced firsthand or watched from a distance as a church wrongly, badly, abusively, or negligently responded to members who had fallen into sin. It would be possible for such a member to recount tales of churches splitting over issues left unresolved, of dominant personalities essentially hijacking whole congregations because congregations did not know how to respond to them or even that they could, or of moral failings in the leadership or the laity that were simply left unaddressed because nobody knew how to address them. Thus, whether churches have a history of these types of situations or not, the modern evangelical will have no problem recalling or recounting some wound in the life of a congregation that might have been avoided and certainly would have been better treated had church discipline been properly understood and practiced.